You are listening to Prometheus by Minute. I am your host, Connor Coulson. This is Minute 81. This minute begins with David saying, "After your father died under such similar circumstances," and ends with Shaw fighting the crew members attempting to put her in cryo. When David says similar, he does this odd head tilt and blink. Did he glitch? Is he okay? I mean, I guess he's not okay, but... Shaw is disturbed at this revelation. She asks him how he knows how her father died. Would this not be public record? Like, is it really that hard to look up someone's date and cause of death and obituary and all of that? Especially for a ruthless and powerful company like Wayland, they would have gathered all the information they could on the people they were hiring. I think it would be more effective if he referenced something really specific, because just saying, "Your father died of Ebola, right?" That's not obscure information. Anyone could get that information. But of course, that's not the point of the scene. The horror comes from David's confession that he watched her dreams. He seems to take some perverse satisfaction in telling her that, in having some kind of control over her, over any human being for once in his life. I don't think I'd be disturbed in this situation. I'd just be like, "How did you watch my dreams? And why? And what else did you see?" I don't think I'd really care that a person, much less a robot, was looking at my dreams. It's not like I consciously chose to think about those things, if it is weird. I'm a millennial, I have no sense of privacy. But the scene is still effectively disturbing. And that's the thing, I don't really have much emotion, so when I watch movies, it's not about whether or not I can relate to what the character is feeling. I'm not emotionally invested in that sense. It has more to do with how well the filmmakers can convince me of what they are feeling, and how justified it seems. David leaves Shaw as she succumbs to the second, but nowhere near last, sedative of the day. He picks something up and carries it out of the room with him. We don't get a clear shot of it, but it looks like a samples container. I think it's more than likely Shaw's cross. Why he takes it, we can't know. He keeps it for personal reasons, as far as we can tell. Later in the film, she asks for it back, and he's kept it in his utility belt. There's no logical reason for that, he just wanted it. Does this reflect his feelings towards her, or is it simply a trophy? A tiny victory over a human. Perhaps his first victory. Shaw falls asleep on her back. In the next shot, she's on her side, so it's unclear how much time has passed, if she rolled over in her sleep, or if she was turned by Ford and the unnamed crew member. I doubt Ford is in on any of this. David or Vickers probably told her to put Shaw in cryo because she is or may be contaminated. She probably wasn't given much more information than that. So, imagining the time it takes for Ford to get this information and get suited up, I guess at least 10 to 20 minutes have passed. Ford slaps Shaw's face to check if she's unconscious. Shaw does a good job of not reacting before she leaps up and hits both over the head with what looks like a metal bedpan. This scene plays out virtually the same in Lindelof's Paradise script. The one difference is this exchange. David: "I'm afraid we don't have any medical personnel equipped to perform a procedure like that. Our best option is to put you back in cryostasis, and evaluate the organism when we return to Earth." Shaw grabs David by the collar, pulls him close. "If you don't get it out, I am going to die. Whatever the engineers were doing here, whatever is in those bottles, it was meant to destroy us." And later, David says, "This may be hard for you to understand, given your faith, but one has to wipe the slate clean before they can start over. You might want to consider that what's inside those glass bottles isn't destruction at all, Dr. Shaw. Maybe it's creation." This is too early for her to come to that realization, and to state it like that is a bit too overt. It is handled much better in Minute 90 when she talks to Wayland. And that exchange between Wayland and Shaw is also in the Paradise script, so it was repetitive and rightly excised. The movie delivers this information at the perfect pace in the most economical way possible. Much to my surprise, this annunciation scene is followed by the one between Vickers and Yannick in the script. I guess I have an intuition for this kind of thing. The Alien Engineer script by John Spaihts is considerably different. Shaw is not impregnated at all, of course, because Holloway died before such a thing could occur. Instead, she goes down into the catacombs and discovers the Juggernaut, and finds David already there. Interior, catacombs. Watts moves through the darkness with her map unit, her headlamp sweeping nervously. A clatter behind her makes her spin, but it's only a spherical mapping probe bumbling through the dark. She walks on. Holloway, off-screen, filtered. Jocelyn! The voice transfixes her where she stands. A look of holy dread on her face, shivering, she prowls towards the sound. Xenomorph Incubator. Watts enters a new chamber, looking around in astonishment. The dome's ceiling is honeycombed with cells like a beehive. Grotesque, molluscoid organisms are secreted in them, their vile orifices cinched tightly shut. Watts stumbles on something. Looking down, she sees a helmet, picks it up. The stenciled label reads Holloway. The clear visor has been melted through by a powerful acid. She looks up. A tracheal air shaft curves up into the dark. An electric crackle, a flare of blue light makes Watts leap back against the wall. Holloway falls out of the overhead shaft and crashes to the floor. He lies in pain, barely conscious. Blue and luminous, a holographic ghost. Jocelyn stares, paralyzed. The ghost gasps out a word. Jocelyn! Holloway's headlamp shines on the molluscoid right overhead. The beam awakens the organism. Its sphincter mouth dilates. A soft white octopoid facehugger descends on a quivering rope of mucus, sprawls slitheringly over his clear visor. Acid hisses, smoke rises from the glass. The vision vanishes in a sizzle of static. Watts huddles against the wall, gasping. In the beam of her flashlight, the facehugger lies dead, legs curled in. She looks up, sees the open molluscoid above, where Holloway lay. The other molluscoids, I hate saying that word, not yet opened in their cells. Terror, she steals out of the chamber. Interior, catacombs, underground hangar. A circular chamber of stunning size, 1,000 feet across. Its lofty ceiling, flat and segmented, designed to open. Watts follows her map into the space in awe. Dominating the hangar is a ship. The vast horseshoe-shaped vessel, familiar from the original film. We will come to know it as the Juggernaut. It's at rest on its landing gear, skeletal gangways slanting up to its 3 massive doors. Watts glances at her map. Holloway's holographic trace leads right up to the gangway into the ship. She goes. Pilot chamber. Watts passes through a circular space with a high domed ceiling. A green glow emanates from grooves in the floor. In the center of the chamber, a pilot's chair. A mechanical throne built to giant scale, its seat segmented like an armadillo's back. Tubes and conduits poised and waiting for some connection. The chair is empty. Above the chair, a massive telescope-like apparatus juts into the air, its function unknowable. Navigation chamber, an extraordinary facility. A console nearly 5 feet high and broad as a dance floor dominates the room. 4 immense coffin-like cockpits are built into the console. In each of these, a navigator, an engineer, lies long dead. But the real spectacle is overhead. The orrery. The barrel-vaulted ceiling is traced with circular arches of some exotic alloy, as if to trace celestial courses. The air above the console is filled with spheres of light. They are nearly still, but close study reveals them all to be in motion, drifting with the movements of the cosmos. Watts stares at the orrery in amazement. Somewhere among those heavenly spheres is Earth. Somewhere, perhaps, the homeworld of the engineers themselves. A bizarre sound, a section of blank wall suddenly unravels itself, becoming an open door. David walks in, his hand raised in command. He clearly calls the door to open. David? Dr. Watts, I didn't expect you. Do you know what this is? Watts points at the door David just opened. How did you do that? A flicker of disappointment in the android's face, contempt. Ah, you don't see, he smiles. I call this ship the Juggernaut, Chariot of the Gods. This is the navigation computer, for want of a better term. But it's much more than that. It seems to hold the observable universe in its memory. He gestures in the air, the spheres reconfigure themselves at his command, swarming and zooming. Watt stares at David, conflicted, her desire for information warring with the agenda that brought her here.
Their homeworld. Do you see where the engineers come from?
There are safeguards on that data. It's towards the galactic center, Sagittarius arm.
David, the creatures that killed Martin. There are thousands of them under the pyramid. Hatcheries.
I know. Watts, shocked.
Those things wiped out the engineers on this moon.
I've succeeded in connecting with the Juggernaut systems, Dr. Watts. I know a great deal today I didn't know yesterday. I'm on the verge of activating more systems. Archives. Watts, horrified.
You're turning things on? This site should be sealed, evacuated.
Would Holloway have walked away from this? There is no greater work I can imagine.
It's too dangerous.
Only for the ignorant, Dr. Watts. I've read your file. Your intelligence scores are even higher than Professor Holloway's, but he had a kind of courage, an audacity of imagination. If you could find that in yourself. Watts stares at him, realization growing in her eyes. David is off the reservation.
If your owner gives you a direct order, you have to obey, don't you?
She's got his attention now. David goes rigid.
I can have Vickers pull you out.
David looks at her with something like contempt. I was given 2 operating protocols for this mission. I was to render you every assistance until you discovered what Vickers would call a game-changing technology. I was given a specific list. Then I was to go to Protocol 2. There's an edge in his voice that scares her.
What's Protocol 2?
Under Protocol 2, I was to make sure that you and Holloway never spoke to anyone about this place. Various acceptable ways of making sure of that. I was given a list. Watts loses her nerve. She heads for the door.
You're all so stupid.
The door begins to knit itself closed in front of her. Watts gasps in shock at the malice in David's voice, as much as the door closing. She dives out. Vaulted passage. Watts runs. Behind her, the door bursts open again. With superhuman speed, David comes after her. He runs like a demon, his legs steel pistons, literally, caroming off walls. He closes the distance in seconds, slaps Watts against the wall, shattering her helmet's visor. She falls, dazed. Stupid and slow. Interior, Juggernaut, egg chamber. Watts awakens. Her helmet is gone. David is dragging her across the floor, into a huge cargo hold full of alien eggs. The wide trench holding hundreds of eggs under a membrane of light. An evolution of the molluscoids Watts saw before. Armored, hardened, darker.
David, what are you doing?
David hauls her upright to let her look across the huge space. His grip looks casual, but it might as well be iron manacles. Juggernaut, the chariot of Krishna, was also a bringer of death, crushing his worshippers under its wheels. He drags Watts down into the trench, breaking the membrane of light, grips her against his chest like a doll with one arm. This ship has 7 other cargo bays like this one, the eggs in each bay slightly different. They've been weaponized. Watts struggles to free herself. David's arm is inescapable. I've seen the Juggernaut's flight plan. Its destination was Earth. 1700 years ago, this was the ship that never came. This was its cargo. David caresses an alien egg. It opens under his touch, fleshy petals folding wetly back. Watts twists frantically in his grip, wild-eyed. Stop! Perfect predators, designed to kill human beings. That's what the engineers were bringing to Earth. This was a death ship. A facehugger emerges from the egg, its grotesque fingers clawing at the air. This is not the boneless squid that attacked Holloway. This is a pale, skeletal hand, armored. David strokes it curiously. The thing ignores his touch, climbs Watts' body. I'm not what it wants, but you, with your warm, wet breath, it knows you.
David, no. No.
The facehugger scuttles towards her face. Watts shrieks. David grabs it nonchalantly by the tail, dangles it in front of their faces, studying it. The engineers did their work too well.
And on this way station moon, the weapon they made destroyed them. Watt shudders, staring at the thing. For a moment, the grander horror eclipses her own peril. Why would they make such things? To destroy their wayward children. And the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, for it repenteth me that I have made them. Genesis 6:7. Yet another asshole in this script who knows Bible quotes by heart. Holloway was doing it as well. It's unnatural and, dare I say, pretentious. Actually, in most versions, it's not just humans. It's like in the New International Version, it says, So the Lord said, I will wipe from the face of the earth the human race I have created, and with them the animals, the birds, and the creatures that move along the ground, for I regret that I have made them. BibleRef.com says, One of the most devastating verses in scripture, verse 7 expresses both God's sorrow in seeing what humanity has become, and his pronouncement that he will wipe from the face of the earth so much of what he has made. These words raise many questions. How can a perfect sovereign God feel sorrow about any action he has taken? God is sorry that man has come to this state. His decision to create man is, in this moment, causing him grief. He is not suggesting that he has made a mistake in creating us. Another question is why God committed to destroy animals and birds along with humanity. This is an issue the Bible gives virtually no guidance on. Big surprise. Ultimately, we can wonder and we can question, but we can't give a dogmatic response. What we do know is that God's sovereignty and ownership over the earth includes animals just as much as humans. Maybe he had a big barbecue that weekend with all the other celestial deities and, you know, you gotta put a lot of meat on that barbie. You know what I mean? All the animals on earth. Did you know in the Bible, this is not apocryphal for me to say other celestial deities, because in the Old Testament, there are other gods. Like, it's not that God says that these gods don't exist, it's just I'm the one true God, or, you know, I'm better in some way, depending on your interpretation. So this actually leads up to Noah, the story of Noah's Ark, which was actually stolen from the Epic of Gilgamesh. That story is referenced in there. Real original Bible. Anyway, so after David has his pretentious Bible school moment, he regards Watts with something almost like pity. I know. I met my creators the day I was born. I was disappointed too. He lets the facehugger go. Watts twists her face away as the long fingers close around her head. Clenches her teeth against the vile proboscis thrusting at her mouth. Her heels hammer the deck, David whispering to her, Extraordinary. The scaly tail throttles her, her mouth opens, the proboscis plunges home, the facehugger seats itself. Watts collapses in David's arms, a faceless ragdoll, her blasphemous passenger secure in its place. So, really different from what we get in the final film. And, I mean, David goes full Covenant mode here. It's basically the scene between him and Orym in Covenant. So I'm glad they held back from that in the film. Prometheus doesn't have overt villains, other than maybe the Engineer. Waylon, David, and Vickers all have their own agendas, but they don't even work against Shaw's goals, really. They're just antagonists, they're not full-blown villains. So I'm glad David's ascent to madness was played out over two films rather than one. This entire, if it is a trilogy, will just be this downward spiral. And speaking of descent, David definitely reminds me of Lore from Star Trek The Next Generation here. Descent was the name of a two-parter. Anyway, it's obscure, whatever. But yeah, Lore, that kind of cartoonish villain, android character, it's very much like that in Engineer script. Whereas I'm glad that the David we got is more sophisticated than that. And actually, I kind of wish that Lore got a chance to be more sophisticated, but what can you do with 45 minutes of television? It's also fun to consider you change one detail and then everything shifts. So Holloway dies during their makeout scene, their romantic scene, if you will. And so everything after that shifts. Up until now, Engineers has sort of followed all the beats that Paradise and Prometheus do, but you change that one detail and suddenly,
Oh, well, nothing can go down that trajectory anymore, or yet. Alright, that about covers it. This is Coulson signing off. You can find me on TravianDesigns.com, TravianOr Prometheus by Minute on Facebook.